Greg, what's your dog doing at my computer?
Is Bruno being terrible again? Is you a bad boy, Bruno? What am I going to do with you?
It looks like he erased a whole bunch of my files and then... Oh, he forwarded some Chinese spam to the company-wide mailing list.
Bruno, do you hear what the mad lady is saying about you? Did you do that, you crazy doggy? What did Daddy say about the computers?
Greg, this dog must weigh 180 pounds. He drools like Niagara Falls, and he uses my computer. You should not be bringing him to work.
Uh-oh, Bruno. I better cover your ears. You don't want to hear what angry lady is saying. Just like our last job where the bad man tried to blame you for killing GeoCities.
Your dog closed GeoCities at Yahoo? That's terrible.
Know what, Bruno? This lady hates doggies like you. She hates all doggies. She doesn't realize how a nice doggie could help her bitter, lonely, rejected life.
Okay, I'm going to stop you right there. I'm not a bitter old lady. I'm young and popular. And the fact that I don't like your dog using my desk doesn't make me a misfit. And that thing when you pretend to talk to the dog when you're really addressing me is weird.
Hear that, Bruno? We're the weird ones, not the crazy, horrible lady. That's okay. We have to go anyway, right? We have opera tickets.
You're taking the dog to the... Never mind. Today on The Nose, Trevor Noah's roller coaster ride toward the anchor chair of The Daily Show. And can you be president if you reject dogs? And now he still hopes this could open the door for Carrot Top, Colin McEnroe.
Yeah, I think that there's like all kinds of people that they didn't consider for The Daily Show job. What about Jeff Dunham and those great puppets? Come on, that would have been wonderful. No, not really. So joining us today, she knows from comedy, comedian Carolyn Payne. She's also a dance impresario, a blogger. I don't know. She does commercials. I mean, I don't know. We could be here all day trying to explain who Carolyn Payne is. One of the founders of The Cut, Connecticut's online magazine for its increasingly disgruntled population of young adults. It's Teresa Kramer. And Rand Richards Cooper, a novelist and a food writer and many other things besides. So that's who's here today. And we are going to begin with the story of Trevor Noah. Trevor Noah obviously became... a lot of people already knew who he was. Apparently, he already had 2 million Twitter followers, but he really became very famous. Is she already laughing about something over there?
Rand is petting the wall.
Oh, he's petting the wall. All right.
It's new textured wall thing
it's
here.
The stuff that's always been there. You've just never sat in that seat.
Okay. All right. Sorry.
So Trevor Noah became much more famous when it was announced this week that he's taking over The Daily Show when Jon Stewart leaves. Trevor Noah is a mixed race person from South Africa. He's handsome and cocky and funny. I'll read for the New York Times. Within hours of the announcement that he'd been named the new host of The Daily Show, the comedian Trevor Noah was subjected to the full scrutiny of the internet. As potential audience members scoured his past work and social media presence for more clues to Mr. Noah, a South African comedian, they uncovered many posts on his Twitter account that they deemed offensive to women or Jews. On Twitter, where he had an account since 2009 and had accumulated more than 2 million followers, Mr. Noah often posts irreverent statements that reflect his interest in popular culture, global politics, and issues of race. As with many comedians, Noah's jokes can test the boundaries of what is socially permissible and what is in bad taste. So we are not going to tell you those jokes because we can't really. But some of them would be offensive. Well, some of them we could, but why do it? Some of them would be offensive to overweight women or to women in general. Some of them would be specifically offensive to Jews and to Jewish women in particular. They are jokes. They're a little rough. I mean, you know, as jokes go. On the other hand, he didn't know he was going to be the host of The Daily Show. So, let's start with the comedian in the bunch. I mean, how do you process all this, Carolyn Payne?
Well, I mean, the whole point of comedy is to stir the pot. Mm-hmm. You're kind of poking the beehive when you're a comedian because you want to get that kind of reaction. I was one of the people who totally delved into a stalker-like search of Trevor Noah when this all hit. I had been aware of him and had heard some of his stuff, but obviously wanted to get to know who was replacing my beloved Jon Stewart more. And, I mean, when you look at him, like, he kind of has everything that you – I mean, he's mixed race. He has this great accent. He's cute. He is really cute. I mean, he's kind of like this whole package. It was like he was like a kill 900 birds with one stone kind of choice that they could get. I'm still kind of on the fence, though, as to whether I think he's right for this job. I think he's funny, and I think that he definitely has a voice as a comedian, but I'm not sure he's who I want for this.
By the way, Ms. Payne did not mean that it's a good thing to kill 900 birds with one stone, all right? Because we live in this culture of outrage. There's somebody writing an email right now. Somebody's tweeting about the dead birds. And, you know, as we go along here, I don't want to only talk about this controversy about Trevor Noah and his tweets, but also sort of about, you know, I mean, what qualifies you for this job, and how do we even try to make a decision about whether somebody will be good at something like this? But we do have to get past one way or another this question. So we have on the panel today people who are relatively difficult to offend. We should have had at least one really thin-skinned panelist here who would, you know, but I don't know, Rand, I mean, or you read those tweets and you read the 82 different articles analyzing the tweets and the problems and the reactions to the tweets, and I don't know, does any of it bother you?
Well, what interests me in it is that the process of scouring someone's past to come up with incriminating things used to be a lot more complicated than it is now. It used to require a lot of effort. Mm-hmm. It was an archival activity. It was getting out and going and digging among old documents activity. Now it's sitting at your computer and trying to look for an incriminating phrase. Twitter. What's interesting to me about it is that we, with our digital culture, we've come to value so highly spontaneity and instantaneity that we're seeing now sort of the downside of it, because Twitter represents a bunch of sort of disposable utterances that used to be things that, you know, were not public. So for a writer, you know, they're maybe equivalent to your first jottings or your first drafts. If you're a comedian, you're probably just tossing out some things in really half-baked or quarter-baked form that might later on in a much more developed way become part of your act, of your thing. So I'm interested in the fact that these tweets, which ultimately have not gotten him in trouble and have not been disqualifying, have sort of been discounted. To me, I don't know much about the guy. I've read his life story. It's fascinating. We can talk about that. Mm-hmm. There are certain aspects of it that I find particularly particularly interesting. But with these, you know, these jokes were really stale. You didn't read them and think, oh, yeah, this guy's an obvious replacement for Jon Stewart. You read them and you thought, oh, my God, you know, this is like stuff that you hear at a bar that's been told a million times. You think, God, can't you come up with a better joke than that? So, you know, that was interesting to me. But it's they've been discounted, and I think they've been treated as disposable utterances, which is appropriate.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I think Chris Rock says, with comedians, there's no rehearsal, right? I mean, the first time you do something, you're going to do it in front of an audience. Now, it might be the smallest club audience you can possibly find. But I think Twitter is starting to be – comedians think that Twitter is kind of like rehearsal, right? You can sort of – you can put a joke out there that you're not 100% sure of, and they see certain kind of very specific Twitter comedians, guys like Rob Delaney, who really sort of specialize in this, putting a joke out there that you might have some reservation about telling
it's
in
like
front of
focus a, grouping.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
And but so yeah, it is. It's
but
a
like
lot.
Like everyone thinks they're a comedian on
yeah,
Twitter.
Right.
Well, it's also weird because most jokes require some sort of setup and context that you can't provide in 140 characters. If you want to do a series or something, that's fine. But like these little one-liners that Trevor Noah was throwing out there were like they were like knock-knock jokes or something. Mm-hmm. they were terrible.
And we know that he's better than that. I mean, three of us anyway have watched African American, his comedy special, his stand-up special. And I actually I was – you know, you may have watched it twice now.
I did, because I watched it many months ago when it first showed up on Netflix, and but I didn't really remember enough of it. So I went back to watch it for this. But then there's also now a documentary about his sort of – the lead-up to him coming to America for his big American debut – And you see a lot of the bits, like there is a bit you may remember from African American where he's talking about coming to America to be black for the first time, and he gets here and people think he's Puerto Rican because he's so light-skinned. But in the documentary, you see him telling that joke, and in it, he's Mexican. And you're like, you don't look Mexican, and it doesn't really make any sense. And the joke is much worse. So it's actually funny to see the evolution of his joke, especially in the context we're talking about him where he told these terrible jokes on Twitter.
Although I will say to that I think he's kind of brilliant about that. That point that he makes, and I'll say this also as the parent, the father of a person who's ethnically and racially Mexican, and my son is mistaken for every possible ethnicity of color that you can imagine, because Americans kind of do that. You know, they look at you and they just sort of flash some set of expectations on you. You're obviously not white, so what are you? I'll decide what you are. People think he's Middle Eastern. They just arbitrarily kind of do that. And I thought he kind of did get that pretty well. And you saw this too. I did think he did some really interesting material in this.
I thought his strength, and where I think that it'll be interesting transitioning into The Daily Show, I thought his strength was his commentary and how he sees America and the differences he sees. I thought that some of those moments were really strong for him. Even just the silly stuff, like where he's talking about the Americans' evolution of language.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that what I pulled from that was, all right, he's going to have a really interesting take on the news that he's delivering, because he kind of has this outsider perspective.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Rand, you said you were fascinated by his life story, and I know that in the past you've talked a lot about how one thing that Americans really have a lot of trouble doing is seeing themselves the way the world sees them. I assume that's kind of part of it too.
Well, and that's what's really interesting about the selection of him. If you're a liberal person, one of the things you admired in Jon Stewart was that he was a pretty cosmopolitan person, and he often took implicitly, not explicitly, a cosmopolitan, international, even European view of us, which some Americans find terrifying and others find salutary. But this guy actually is not American. And one thing, when I was reading about him, there's a good article in the New York Times about his life, and he's a mixed race person. His father was Swiss. His mother was a South African, black African. He lived with her. His parents lived in different worlds. I don't know exactly what their relationship was. It didn't quite make it clear.
I don't think from the documentary, it doesn't seem as though they were ever married. And he, lived in the city, and he lived with his mother in the townships. And
the very –
It was during apartheid.
Yes.
He was born really in the dying phase of apartheid. And the article mentioned that in order for the three of them to be united, given the racial strictures of the time – his mother sometimes posed as the maid in his father's white apartment complex so that the three of them could be together. Now, to develop a very racially conscious comedy out of that, I mean, obviously that is very, very rich ground for pretty fascinating and challenging material. But what's interesting to me, among many things, is that 20 or 30 years ago, the world has grown together so conspicuously. 20 or 30 years ago, you would not at all be able to expect that any entertainer from South Africa would have a significant enough purchase on the complexities of American society, American government, to deliver anything like the nuanced and informed perspective that a Jon Stewart can give. It's fascinating, and it's certainly going to be a daunting challenge for someone, no matter how adept, how smart, and how much time he's spent here, which for him hasn't been that much, to walk in and situate yourself in a bunch of realities that are substantially different, although related to, the ones that you're familiar with.
I mean, this also raises the question of what does it take to be good at a job like this? And I think we could all agree that the most hilarious comedian in the world is not necessarily suited for these 4 or 5 night a week gigs. This has to do with a bunch of other factors. I mean, it sure helps to be really funny, but I mean, we really kind of make these decisions also based on our comfort level with the person. Do you want to, seeking out somebody's stand up special once a year is really different from I want to be with this person 4 nights a week, and so what that person, what you bring to the table that way. Yeah, what were you going to say?
Well, I think that it's a different. When somebody's doing stand-up, like when I'm doing stuff, it's a part of you. Whereas now that he's taking on Daily Show, he's going to have to create a character that is that Daily Show persona. Jon Stewart, it was sort of this newscaster, but with that rage backing it. And so I'm just interested in seeing who he creates and how because just based on him as a comedian, I don't connect with him as somebody who like I see doing that.
Do you think there's going to be the expectation that he do some version of the same thing that
John
Stewart
did?
No,
and I hope he doesn't. Uh-huh. I know, and that's the
so
sad.
So it might not be news-based that way at all?
Oh, no, he's got to be news-based.
It'll be news-based.
And I think he's got to follow the format, too.
Yeah, right. But I think it'll just be a very different show. I think we just all have to, like, let go of the original Daily Show and just...
But that person, as you say, has to be a very special kind of comic, and you have to be, among other things, a real news junkie, a real news geek, and you have to be very adept at quickly spinning, contextualizing, and riffing off actual stuff that's happening in almost real time.
Well, it's funny because so his stand-up special was not particularly topical, right? It's a lot about his life, that sort of thing. But in that documentary, they show a lot of the stuff he does in South Africa where he's talking about more topical things. And like he does this thing about Nelson Mandela's 90th birthday and how he hopes he's just out there getting drunk. And then he does this whole impression of Nelson Mandela drunk and just like raging. And And it was hilarious. I mean, it's hilarious. And he does that. He did this whole thing about how he had to pretend to be albino as a kid because he couldn't say that he had a white father. And all the other albinos were like, "What? Why can you go out in the day? I don't understand." And they started calling him the daywalker. And and he had to tell them that he was not actually an albino when he was finally allowed to say what he really was. But.
He has the line in his other comedy special where I think he's talking to somebody who's Latino and he's insisting that he's from Africa.
Yeah.
And the guy's going, "You don't look like you're from Africa." And he goes, "No, I'm from Africa." And he goes, "You kind of look like you grew up in the shade."
Yeah.
But, you know, like when I lived in Germany for 6 years, and no matter how deeply enmeshed in a language you become and how good at it, you still lack this deep reservoir of cultural associations, reference points, TV shows from 20 and 30 years ago, all that stuff that feeds in to what someone like Jon Stewart does and is useful to him in a very, very broad field of available references. It's going to be a very big challenge for this guy to come in.
Well, I agree.
It's also easy to forget that he has a team of writers who know all that stuff and that we import our culture to everybody.
So it's going to come down to, even though he's an outsider, he has that outsider opinion, which I actually think is going to be fresh, it's going to come down to his team of writers and his delivery. And based on that's where I'm hesitant because I feel like he has great delivery for his stuff, but is he going to be able to deliver news with a snarky persona? Or what is his persona going to be? How is he going to take this on? Because he's very soft-spoken when it comes down to it is the other thing. He just has that, you know, in moments just when he's talking.
Yes, you kind of want to hug him a lot.
Although I will say, watching him do an extended stand-up thing, one of the things that I always thought about Jon Stewart is, in addition to everything else that we like about Jon Stewart, a lot of his evenings were this vocal tour de force where, I mean, he screamed, he whispered, he slipped into falsettos. I mean, he used his voice incredibly elastically in addition to impersonating various Warner Brothers cartoon characters and doing Lieberman as Droopy Dog and you know, and Mitch McConnell as the turtle and stuff. His voice was incredible. And listening to Trevor Noah, he does a lot of accents.
He does.
I mean, really kind of brilliantly. And actually, his voice is a very powerful instrument that he can control and modulate and use for a lot of different effects.
He's really good with impressions, too. A couple of just the small impressions that he does.
He also speaks something like 5 or 6 languages. And during that documentary, I'm going to keep going back to it, but you see him talking to other South Africans and all the different types of South Africans and the languages they speak and him doing each one differently. And I didn't get it, but I still thought it was funny, you know, and they thought it was hilarious.
He has a whole take on the phrase, "You know what I mean," among African-Americans, urban African-Americans. And it's fabulous. I mean, he really does this amazing job
naming
with it.
His baby that.
I just wanted to bring up one last thing, and maybe just something that I want to say, but maybe also I was looking at this furor over the cycle of outrage, as we say, over his tweets. And I was just thinking how already in 2015, I'm so tired of this. I'm so tired of this kind of fly-specking activity. I mean, as Rand described, it's kind of like, you know, you just look at this stuff and you think, wow, is there something I can be offended by? It's like you're putting your hands in through this sandboxed and sifting around, but the jewel you want to come up with is really a piece of dog poop, right? Yeah, you're really happy if you can find – at least there's a kind of person
who's, segue there,
you know, who's really happy if they can find this awful thing that they can get outraged about. And I mean, you know, whether it's Lena Dunham is an anti-Semitic piece in The New Yorker or – I mean, it just – like it's like every day there's something like this. And I was having a conversation last night with a fellow journalist who was upset at me for defending online and on a blog post yet another journalist. And she was sort of saying that she wanted that person to be suspended for a week. And I finally said to her, you know what? The one promise I can make to you is when you screw up – when you screw up and they want to, and some people are screaming for you to be suspended from your job, I'll write a post defending you no matter what you've done, all right? Even though you don't get it right now. But that I feel in 2015, it's like worse somehow. I've just encountered more of these things where I read about somebody who's done this awful, horrible thing and we have to do something about it. And then I find out what it is and I go, God, this doesn't seem that bad.
Well, it's another problem with social media. It just gives the people who used to just be quietly outraged at home, hating on somebody, now get to talk about it on Twitter and then it ends up on the news. And it's why John Ronson wrote a book about the culture of shaming. And it's why, and hopefully he can do something about this because for many, many years, I have just been annoyed by people who are offended by everything. I can't live with them.
I don't get the being offended by everything, but I get the wanting to feel rage about everything. I kind of like don't feel alive if I'm not mad about something. Okay, and I know that's awful.
But go be mad about something important. Stop caring what Lena Dunham said about her boyfriend.
I got an email this week from somebody who said that my comments about Charles Barkley's comments about moving the Final Four from Indiana had, in his words, racist overtones. And I thought, buzz off. Go away. All right, you get the last word about that if you want one.
People need to be laughing more.
Right. Well, maybe Trevor can help us with that. Let's take a break. As Rand pointed out, we do have a segue to make. Can you get elected president or in other ways be embraced by the American public if you do not love dogs? Well, you must love dogs. We have an African-American president, or as Trevor Noah would say, a president of mixed race. But can we ever have a president who doesn't like dogs, or at least kind of doesn't do dogs? Scott Walker may or may not like dogs, but he's very, very allergic to them. Mr. Walker, who gives a gloomy stump speech filled with worry, reported the New York Times this week, perhaps could use a four-legged image softener of his own. But he's allergic to dog dander, and in that he is running against the long sweep of United States political history, says the Times. If the ritual for presidential candidates wooing American voters had a handbook, must love dogs would be somewhere near the front. The article goes on to cite all the examples of this. So, and I mean, when this article appeared, I thought I had never really thought about this before, you know, but it kind of is true that, Teresa, if you don't love dogs, I mean, it's not just that you don't love dogs, but people impute like a whole bunch of other things to you too. You're like, why don't you like dogs?
Well, yeah. So I think one of the things I use to figure things out about people I meet is their pets and the story behind those pets and where they chose to get them. Like Carolyn rescued her cat from a subway platform and was warned by a veterinarian that several other people had brought this cat in and then were like, never mind, it's insane. But she still owns that cat, and that says
you mean
a
people,
lot about Carolyn.
People were like bringing the cat back to the subway platform?
Yes. Or dumping it out on the street and it kept going to the subway.
And vets knew that somehow?
Yeah. Like I took it to when I took it to like a local shelter. I was living in Brooklyn at the time, and I like took it there and I was like, hey, you know, I found this cat. I went to have it checked out, and they recognized her. And they were like, this cat has been in here before. You really don't want her. Just put her back out on the street. And I was like, no, she's precious. She's mine. Yeah. And as we have talked about on the show, she has like attacked cable repairmen, me.
But this all says a lot about Carolyn, right? It's a very funny, dramatic, kind of wacky story. All of those things would be used to describe Carolyn. So if you don't like dogs and you don't have a pet that I can judge you by, then I just start thinking, like, well, if you don't like dogs, do you just, like what do you do with yourself? I don't even understand. I can't even comprehend such a thing.
Yeah, I just don't understand people who don't love animals.
Right.
And, you know, I think as far as presidential candidates, I mean, Bill Clinton had a cat, right?
Socks. Yeah. He had Socks. Yeah. He also had Buddy.
Yes. Yeah. He had a dog, too. And I do think that, you know, your animal sidekick does say a lot about you. And I think that I like people who have an animal sidekick. They're a little...
You know, it also says something about your level of responsibility that you can keep it alive, right? Like, if
true.
You're single, right? Like, if you meet a guy and he's got a dog, or, you know, he has to come home every day or his house will be pooped on.
You don't think you don't think the president really feeds Bo, do you? I mean...
Well, no, but we're talking about a much lower sense.
Rand, I'm sure you have a lot of things to say about this, but before you say any of the other ones, I want to go back to what we said in the previous segment. Because is this kind of an American thing? I mean, there's some countries, obviously, in the world where dogs really are kind of regarded as unclean and nasty, and nobody important would want them around.
Right. Well, I have two perspectives on that, having lived for several years in Kenya and East Africa, and also having lived in Germany. In the developing world, often dogs have this inhabit this twilight zone between pet and sort of free scavenger. And so if you're living in an East African village, there are dogs, pretty mangy critters, who sort of just generally live there, and someone will toss them something, but they're not taken into homes and families in the same way. A few years after I got back from living in East Africa, I wrote a story that had a Kenyan character who comes to this country and experiences a period of homelessness. And there's one scene in this story I wrote, and he's walking down a street in a suburban town, and it's getting cold, and some snowflakes are coming down. He's never seen snow before, and he's looking inside the homes, looking in the windows, and he's imagining dogs in the houses. And he imagines dogs up on furniture, dogs in beds, their furry sides heaving in and out, dogs being fed from human tables. And he finds the whole thing grotesque and awful, an awfulness that's amplified by the fact, of course, that he is excluded and dogs have, in effect, usurped a bunch of human comforts. So it is possible to channel, in a cultural sense, the point of view of a culture that sees our intimacy with household animals as, frankly, strange. Having lived in Germany, I went way to the other extreme. And even from an American point of view, it can be a little shocking, you know, to be in a cafe and have a large dog, you know, hit your ankle. Or to go into a store, as I did in my favorite small grocery store, and have a little lady holding her dachshund up to the glass of the butcher display and saying, "Oh, ja, Schatzi, was willst du jetzt heute Abend essen? What do you want to eat tonight from this beautiful meat?" And so, you know, like an American goes, whoa, you know, no. So this stuff is obviously culturally constructed and gives us wide variations of sort of appropriate intimacies between humans and domesticated animals.
Well, dogs can go more and more places now. I was
it's
in
true.
Marshalls.
We're becoming European.
Yeah, Marshalls lets you bring your dog in as long as it fits in the carriage. I learned this recently because I was in Marshalls and there was a girl with a cute dog in her carriage and I struck up conversation with her. I was like, "Oh, I didn't know that your animal could come shopping with you." And she's like, "Oh, yeah, Marshalls lets you bring it in as long as it's in the carriage." And I kind of wanted a dog at that moment just so I could...
Let's try it. Let's take
not
my
your
dog.
Cat. Yeah, your cat. Can't yeah. Yeah. Or anywhere, really. I just want to say as we won't be on this topic terribly long, but if you have a comment, particularly on this whole question, is, you know, would you trust a presidential candidate who had no relationship with dogs? 860-275-7266. You may have other reasons to distrust Scott Walker, but we don't care about those right now. It's the dog thing. 860-275-7266. Although I do want to say to both Carolyn and Teresa, I mean, it's worth acknowledging that some absolutely appalling people have had dogs.
Yeah, like
have had
Nazis.
Like Hitler. Hitler had Blondie, right? Blondie, was that the name of his dog? Mm-hmm. I think so. So you
Himmler
know,
loved dogs.
Yeah. And that there are, I'm sure, some very perfectly nice people who just because of their upbringing or whatever, you know, and there weren't dogs in the house, they never got comfortable with them. You know?
Well, as we discovered last night, Robert Durst was very upset about the suggestion that he had murdered his dogs over the years.
Right.
But
he
had
totally
no problem.
Is okay with killing women, dragging them by the hair, but I did not hurt that dog. He made that very clear.
I do think that most adults I know who don't like dogs, and I have to say as a dog owner, we have two, and a dog lover, you can't help but feel chagrin and indignation when it becomes clear that someone who's in your home, maybe even a friend of yours, does not like your dogs or dogs in general and considers dog owning to be, even though they suppress this, a filthy habit. You know, and you just – then you begin to think, who are you to think that,
you question
that dog owning is a filthy habit? And then you start in a small way to hate them.
Well, I see. You know, I sort of feel the same way, but only in my home. Like, we read this article about the Amazon culture of dog having in the office, and I can understand why that would be
this is Amazon.com. Mm-hmm. I just want to emphasize, not the Amazon.
Yes. So they have dogs everywhere to make you forget that you never get to go home. And if I had to work in an office with hundreds of people's poorly behaved dogs, I would lose my mind. And I don't want to go shopping with your Newfoundland. And I don't, you know, like, and if your dog is at a cafe outside, that's fine. But please keep it off my table because I will freak out. But if you're in my house, you've made it, these things live here. This is my lifestyle and you're just going to have to deal with it.
I do think – well, first of all, I should say that when I go to Rand's house, I mainly interact with the dogs.
Oh, completely.
Yeah.
I struggle for eye contact with Colin. I can never get it because he's making out with the dogs.
Yeah. But I mean I think there's also – there's some embodiment of some American principle in all this. And I don't know whether – I think even you might suggest that maybe it connects back to TR or something. It's hard to sort of say, but it really – it's expected that presidents will have dogs. And every single president not only has a dog but has a dog story. There have been some bad dog stories. Reagan had to get rid of a dog named Lucky, who was just out of control. They couldn't control the dog, and suddenly, like, Lucky wasn't there anymore. And it was like he had to tell America, kind of, you know, what your parents used to tell you. Oh, Lucky went to a farm. LBJ picked up a dog by the ears. I think he had a basset hound or a beagle or something like that, and he picked it up by the ears because that was like what he did. And America was appalled. And Nixon's Knickers speech. Nixon's checker speech. I mean, sort of, you know, it became a placeholder for the notion that Nixon was manipulative and would use almost anything, including his kid's
dog.
Which
is a little risky. Like, let's say they outfit Walker with a dog, and they manage to find a minimally dander-laden
hypoallergenic, and he gets shot.
I mean, there's a risk, right? There's a risk in this, in that if you feel like the thing with the dog is just totally phony, then it seems
worse.
Then it's much worse than not having a dog.
Now you're just manipulating me because you know I want to see you cuddle a dog.
Well, right. This is a larger stage for what we feel about cat people versus dog people. Dog people are outgoing and they're, you know, energetic and they're robust and they like to go hiking and walk their dogs, even though most people just sit around and, you know, let their dogs languish in the backyard. And cat people just lay on a couch talking to themselves. And
it's true.
And so, you know, we had this whole email discussion about what pets are acceptable. So if you do have this severe dog allergy, but you really love animals, what pets are you allowed to have and not be a complete weirdo? And I've decided that a pig is an acceptable pet for a president, but ferrets are probably not. I don't know where everybody else stands.
I think,
on this.
You know what?
I'm okay with ferret. I just don't like the idea of a snake. Like, there
but listen,
a
listen. A president,
snake.
If a president had a ferret and really loved the ferret, that person, not a president, a presidential candidate, that person is not going to get elected.
And I don't know if you guys remember the famous phone call that Rudy Giuliani took. He used to do this show when he was the mayor of New York, where people could call in, and somebody called in about whether it should be legal to have ferrets. And Giuliani went nuts, and he started saying, "A ferret is a weasel. You're sick if you." He said, "Tell me the person he was sick to even want such a pet." I mean, he kind of some. It was like maybe he'd been tortured with ferrets as a little boy or something. His reaction was that visceral. So, Rand, one thing that you were doing, we're gonna have to wrap this up and move on to something else. Although we've got a call that I want to get to too. But you circulated. I mean, you raised a question and circulated kind of a list of like what are the other things that you have to subscribe to somehow or other to be acceptable to 51% of
right.
American
to
people.
Me, what the dog thing with Walker illustrates is that we have such a narrow range of attributes, predilections, hobbies, things that you like that we would find acceptable in a president. And I just thought about, you know, the ranks of people I know and the friends I – and, you know, there are plenty of people who dislike dogs, but we might not elect one. There are, like, plenty of people who consider baseball to be a deadly boring game. Are you going to get elected if you say, you know what, I just can't stand baseball. I've always found it really boring. I way prefer soccer. Can't stand baseball. You're done. Can you be a vegetarian? I don't know. I don't think we'd elect – a vegetarian as president.
What is the tipping point, too? Because as, you know, so as the electorate
You can be a gamer,
younger,
but not a LARPer. I know you, that.
You,
is.
You can be a gamer, and at some point when our nation becomes less and less old and white, will soccer be the sport of choice? Because there, I mean, plenty of my friends are big soccer fans.
I think Obama already broke that umbilical mm-hmm. cord. He said that if he had a son, he wouldn't let his son play football.
Right.
But yeah, we probably are 10 years away, Carolyn, from our first gamer president.
That'll be exciting.
I will not vote for them. I've dated one. I will not vote
but
for them.
But will they have had time to hold a campaign while, yeah, right. you know.
But you can't be into live-action role-playing. You can't go to Star Trek conventions. Maybe we'll have our first nerd president, too. Probably wouldn't be our first. All right, we got a little bit of time left here in this segment. Oh, I promised I would get to this call. I got to do that. Here's Brock in Harwinton. Hi, Brock.
Hey, hello, Carolyn.
How are you?
I recall a thing some years back, and I wanted to try it out if you would see if you had the same memory or not, of some politician who got his picture taken with his family in his living room in front of the hearth, and apparently he had rented an Irish setter or something to be in the picture with him. And the word got out, and apparently, you know, he got pounded.
Hounded. He probably hounded out of office. I don't remember that. I hope profoundly that it's true, you know, and that the dog was doing like a Lloyd Buchner thing, blinking in Morse code, saying, "I'm not really the dog. Please
rent
please
a setter."
Yeah.
The family ferret was just seething with anger.
Right.
I
will
frame.
Say, Colin, in 2012, my daughter was 6 years old, and the one thing she knew about the presidential campaign was that she would never vote for a candidate who strapped his dog to the roof of the car.
That was big, yeah. That was a big, unfortunate mess to have come out.
Especially for the dog. But all right, so very briefly, we don't have a lot of time for this, but one thing that Rand sent around in his ongoing war against digital technology was an article about this new You Pay. It's actually a national program. It's a $2.3 million grant that it's helping pay for the effort. But several police departments in Connecticut are doing this. The Hartford Courant reported there was yelling, crying, and quiet seething Wednesday as Hartford police handed out close to 100 tickets during the first leg of a month-long statewide effort to prevent distracted driving. I would like to say that my personal favorite part of this article was that the police said that it was frequently hard to flag the drivers down to give them tickets because they weren't paying any attention, that they brought a special whistle that they thought maybe the drivers would hear because that they knew just waving their hands near the drivers was not going to work. But so I know you have something to say about this.
Well, I'm obviously irrationally vehement on this topic, but I'm tired of being at a stoplight with a car in front of me that doesn't go when it's green. It's automatic now. You have to beep your horn whenever a light turns green because the person in front of you has got their head bent down in their device. My animus about this, which is pretty boundless, has to do with this rage that people feel when they're separated from their devices for even short periods of time. I've got friends who teach in college classes, and they are unable to get their students to turn off devices for 48 minutes. One of them had a policy, just you leave your device at the front of the room. Here's a basket. I never touch your device. You pick it up at the end. This person was unable to do that, got hauled into the dean's office because such and such student complained. There's almost no one who can offer an actual rational principled argument for why they absolutely have to have their device on and on them at all times. And yet that's becoming the reality. It's a physical extension of ourself in a way that no other technology has been.
Well, except for cars. Cars are a physical extension. I think Teresa can offer an irrational, unprincipled argument against you.
Well, my problem is not with turning off the thing or putting it in my bag and not looking at it. My problem is with you trying to get me to put my iPhone in a basket of, you know, 30 other iPhones and all of us having to figure out whose is whose at the end.
Well, the only reason that's necessary is that people will say, I'm going to turn off for 48 minutes, and then they don't.
Right.
They won't.
It's maybe it is their own fault. But I would also be mad. My objection to the – I have – no one should be texting and driving. Stop it. You're going to kill somebody. But – while I was watching one of the news items on this, they were saying that it is also considered distracted driving now to eat behind the wheel. And one lady said, I just had it in my hand. I wasn't even texting. I was putting it down. And yeah, she probably was lying. But if you were not proving that someone is texting, if you can wave your phone and say, look, there are no texts, I wasn't doing anything, then I don't see how a crime has been committed. And at what point do we say, you know, the radio is a distraction, the conversation with the person next to you is a distraction, your screaming child in the back is a distraction.
My car itself is a distraction.
Listen, an accident can happen. Obviously, we've all had situations where you do something with the radio for 1 second and it's just the wrong moment and you come that close. But I mean, if it's 1 second, you have to be very unfortunate, very unlucky to have an accident. If it's 5 seconds, you sort of have to be lucky not to have an accident.
Right, so there's criminalizing me eating a bagel. And I don't like it.
Yeah, where am I supposed to eat all my meals if I can't eat in the car?
Yes. You have to outlaw drive-thrus because there are all these accessories in cars that are incredibly distracting, and they're just getting more and more.
I don't think there have been any ticketed bagel eaters yet.
My new car is more distracting in some ways. It's the kind of car like I talk to it. Like I can be like, call mom or play Beyonce. And even just like fiddling with that stuff, I feel like I'm more prone to distraction now.
But if it's voice activated, it sounds like it's
ideal.
I
know, but yet somehow I feel like I've lost focus.
Well, 10 years from now, we'll all be in driverless cars anyway, so this thing will just be moot.
Yeah. Right.
It's a little 10-year period we have to get through. I do think I was reading the same thing that Teresa was reading and thinking, well, some of this seems a little bit draconian, what they're talking about. Although I feel also with phones in particular, there's a kind of mission creep, right, that that everybody has. I mean, I have a hands-free set, and I even have sort of the goofy thing that looks like I'm taking, you know, an American Airlines reservation or something. I don't even have a cool-looking Bluetooth because I just don't like them. But, you know, it's kind of like, okay, so I'm hands-free, right, except that you have to kind of look at your phone and maybe scroll down some a contact list or, you know, I mean, after a while, you're not really hands-free. I mean, it's like I would tell a cop, look, I got my headset on, obviously. But the truth is, there are some times when my eyes will cut away just to, you know, just to do the visual part of this whole task.
But that's the whole point with, like, even with this, like, I have the completely, like, hands-free, the sink on the – but it doesn't always hear you right. Like, you say, you know
– And then you're fighting with the car.
Right. You say, like, play Beyonce, and it starts playing Kanye West. And you're like, no, Beyonce. And now you're, like, having a fight with your car. And that you're just – even though your eyes are on the road, you're not really there. I just don't. I'm beginning to think I should just not have media in the car.
Can
it's
you still
starting
return
to sound
the car?
That way, yeah. Yeah. Right. Return the car and the cat and start your whole life over. Is my advice.
Rethink everything.
All right. Do I have time? I'll take this one call real quickly. Hi, Dave. You're on the air.
Colin.
Yes.
I was listening to another show this morning, and a guy called in and said that his 27-year-old daughter has been nailed a few times for texting. And her insurance rates have gone up to $8,000 a year.
Good.
So there is some disincentive out there. But as far as distraction in the car, anything is distracting.
Yeah, but
my phone stopped communicating to me through my car, and it stopped communicating to me through my watch. I am so upset.
Well, thanks for your call. I do want to say, as somebody who's out on a bicycle a lot, texting – I feel like the person who's texting is basically trying to kill me. I mean, to me, that's a separate category. And it is. I'm glad whoever's daughter's insurance rates are $8,000 won't begin to cover my hospital costs, but it's a start anyway. All right. We have to take a little break so we can come back for endorsements after this.
And she woke me from my sleep. You should have heard the things she said. You know she hurt my feelings deep. I'm gonna buy me a dog.
A dog. Why?
'Cause I need a friend now.
Come on, Bruno. The memo is supposed to go directly to Lee Newton. And then she sends it to her distribution list. When are you going to get that through your dumb dog head? Today's show was produced by Colin McEnroe and me, Kyone Wolf, with no help at all from Milkbone Brain over here. Our interns are Kelsey Bissell and Sydney Lauro. Greg Hill appeared in the intro and tweets for us at WNPR Colin. The part of Bill Curry was played by Buddy in Socks. For show pages, articles, and videos of the Faith Middleton Show staff deleting all their fat chicks tweets, visit our website, WNPR.org. On Monday's show, it's The Scramble, our quick turnaround show on the weekend's news. And now, back to Colin.
Yeah, who knew those tweets were such a liability? We just found out. Everybody's deleting them. All right, so it's time to do endorsements. Oh, I just want to say that Greg Hill, our tweet master, who you can tweet at WNPR, Colin, just came in here and pointed out that Frank Underwood is on House of Cards. He's the president. He doesn't have a dog. He doesn't have a kid. He smokes. He does all kinds of things presidents are not supposed to do. But he's also the embodiment of evil. I mean, he's basically Richard III. It tends to make the point of people who say you can't trust a guy who doesn't have a dog to be our president. Anyway, it's time to do endorsements. We'll start out with Ryan. What have you got for us?
For those of you who like horror movies, go see It Follows. It's a frankly terrifying film. Colin won't see it because he's afraid he's going to have a stroke during it. I have two book recommendations. One is a book called Station 11. It just won the Tournament of Books contest. It's by Emily St. John Mandel, M-A-N-D-E-L, and it's a futurist dystopia about the world trying to reconstitute itself after a plague wipes out 95% of humanity. It's a beautifully written book. It has broad appeal, not just for people who like that literary niche. And it's a book full of nostalgia for the world that we live in now. Second book is a book called American Reckoning by a UMass historian named Chris Oppy, A-P-P-Y. It's a book about the political legacy of Vietnam. It's really about American exceptionalism and how, in Oppy's view, we failed to learn the lessons of Vietnam. And it's about the backlash against our participation in Vietnam. Finally, one restaurant recommendation. I don't know how I missed going to this restaurant for like the first 12 years I lived in Hartford. It's called Primavera Pub. It's a Portuguese restaurant, the very south end of Hartford. And it's a hole-in-the-wall place. If you go in there, it's like everyone who was just in the Portuguese club around the corner half an hour ago came around the corner, and it is amazing seafood, cheap Portuguese wine, friendly reception, hearty food. I love it. Lots of garlic.
All right. Those were many recommendations. Teresa Kramer, what have you got for us?
I went to see The Pianist of Willesden Lane this week at the Hartford Stage. Mm. I didn't know what to expect. I won the tickets. I didn't know what I was going to see, and I was blown away. It was really, really great.
Oh, great. Mm-hmm. One-person show, right?
Yes.
Yes. Mm-hmm. All right. So that's an endorsement. Carolyn Payne, what have you got for us?
All right. Three quick things. One is our friends at CT Improv are trying to get a comedy theater here in Hartford. They have a Kickstarter going, and everyone should donate to that and get comedy here. And two is Majorca, the restaurant in Hartford, and they do a great happy hour. It's seriously like $5 cocktails and wine and food, and then their food is just amazing. I recently discovered it and am obsessed. And three is kind of a funky little one, but there is an app for your phone. It's a game. I'm being a gamer. It's called Flow. It's like this little game, and it's just a great little brain puzzle thing. And it's just nice if you kind of need to like zone out for a second. Don't do it while driving, though.
Not while driving. All right. So what have I got here? First of all, I want to sort of second the endorsement of the CT Improv concept, which I'm actually referring to as the Colin McEnroe Comedy Theater. But the naming rights, I'm sure, will be heavily debated. Just don't call it the Yard Goats Laugh House or something like that. But it's a great idea to have an actual comedy theater and CT Improv. I mean, they're sort of an amazing institution. So yeah, that's a really great idea. And they do have a Kickstarter campaign, and we'll be reminding you about it as we go along. It's just I really like the idea. I've endorsed this before, but I want to endorse it now just because you have a chance to see it the right way. The Mike Leigh movie Mr. Turner, which is about about J.M.W. Turner, the British painter, is at Trinity Cine Studio right now. And this is the way to see it. In fact, there's like a whole class of movies that if you're not going to see them on a really big screen with really good sound equipment, you know, with well-maintained equipment, which you often don't get at the multiplex, don't bother. Don't see them at all. If you watch this on your 46-inch Samsung, you will not understand why anyone cares about this movie at all. But if you go to Trinity Cine Studio this weekend and see it, you will understand just the magnificence of the movie. And if you're really knocked out by it, be aware that Mike Leigh is coming to New Haven, the director, Mike Leigh, coming to New Haven as part of the Arts and Ideas Festival in June. He'll be there, I think, at the British Arts Center at Yale to talk about the movie and about Turner. They have the They're closed right now for renovations, but they probably have the biggest Turner collection in America at the British Museum at Yale. So those two things. And then just a special thing, which is Wednesday night. Wednesday night, please come to Watkinson School. David Edelstein, America's greatest living film critic, will be joining me on stage for a conversation, a wide-ranging conversation and argument about movies. It's part of Freshly Squeezed. Check Watkinson.org or call Watkinson School to find out about tickets. They're very cheap. And you can even come and have buffet dinner with us, and the dinner is good. So do that. And thanks to Rand and to Carolyn and to Teresa. We'll be back on Monday with a scramble.
What's that, Bruno? Are you trying to do the last word? Are you trying to take my job? It's a good thing you can't talk, because... I love you, too.